HPPodcraft.com.
Like the guy says in the movie Drac Draft, I'll be Drac.
This is the comment show for April, and we're going to be talking all about Marches for Draculas.
In which we covered I Am Legend with a loose layer of soil. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. This is Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
It is. You know, last night I was watching The Invisible Pilot, which is a documentary, short documentary series on HBO. I didn't get through much of the first episode. Mm-hmm. It was good. One of the main subjects is around my age, and he was talking about his weird childhood, and I thought, man, I'd totally be friends with this guy. Mm-hmm. And just as soon as I said that, to illustrate his disaffected state when he was young, he goes, and I was reading lots of H.P. Lovecraft. And then they flashed all these Lovecraft paperback covers, which is all to say that we're still the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast for a while longer. And we'll talk all about moving on and moving up with the show and me personally and all that kind of stuff in our bonus episode, which will be out around this time next week. Mm-hmm. It'll be a little potpourri like this month. We just want to catch up. Also, it was just Easter, so a great time to resurrect I Am Legend itself. Right. About people returning from the dead. There, and I'm go. Sure I Am Legend has been the subject of some college papers. At least one of those has had to be Christ imagery in I Am Legend, right? I mean, at some point.
I'm sure.
Well, let's get into it.
I Am Legend Part 1, H.R. Price writes, when life gives you Draculas, you make Draculade.
Mm-hmm.
And for writing that song, you deserve Draculades.
Draculades is even better than Drac Draft. Thank you, H.R. Price.
Jason Thompson writes, Year of the Plague is a magnetic field song, question mark? I like it.
Yeah, that's what I was going for. By the way, I had no idea that Wig song was going to be coming up, you know, in the episode at the beginning of this month.
Yeah.
I really thought Year of the Plague was going to be the cool, edgy, gothy sounding last song I recorded in L.A., but no. Wig song. Wig song was my last bit of audio. It was my last bit of musicianship in Hollywood. That seems more appropriate. Rob Gilley writes, okay, to start with, great song, but I've seen The Last Man on Earth starring Vincent Price. I think in that first episode, you hadn't watched it yet.
I hadn't seen it yet.
He writes, I was just a kid, and one of the TV stations in LA used to show monster movies on Saturday afternoons. One Saturday, that was the movie. My dad was at work and my mom was out shopping, so there I was all alone watching this poor guy trying to stay alive in a world full of vampires. Tries to make friends with the dog, but then he has to stake it because, yes, the dog has become a vampire. Every night the vampires surround his house, pounding on the walls and doors, calling out his name. And in the movie, his name is Robert. Hey, that's mm-hmm. my name too. At some point in the movie, it all became too much. I turned off the TV, ran, and hid in the bathroom, which was the only room in the house that didn't have windows. It was a fine sunny afternoon in LA when I was watching the movie, but that didn't matter. There are vampires, they are coming to get me, and they know my name. Eventually, my mom came home and found me hiding in the bathtub. Did you watch a scary movie? She asked so nicely. She told me years later she was trying not to laugh at me. Somehow, she convinced me to get out of the tub and come out of the bathroom. Vampires were just in movies. They weren't real. Come have a grilled cheese sandwich. Play with your poor dog who was really worried about you hiding in the tub like that. To this day, I have still not watched that movie again. I know that as a grown-up now, with my own friends and keys and credit cards, that Last Man on Earth won't be scary at all. And I really cherish the memory of being so terrified by a vampire movie that I had to go hide in a bathtub on a sunny Saturday afternoon. Wow. I thought that story might have a curveball ending, like, hey, come out and play with your poor dog. By the way, where is the dog? Robert, what did you do?
What I love about that story too is he watched that during the day.
Yeah.
And it still scared him that much. Imagine at night, you'd probably be institutionalized.
Yeah, we wouldn't have him commenting on this show.
Eric W. Mertz writes, ha! Jaws in 3D. I saw it in the Bronx movie theater as a 7-year-old with my grandfather I'd never met who only spoke Italian. He shouted and cursed at the screen from curtain to credits, and I had no idea what he was saying.
Queste volte è personale! This time it is personal! Vendetta!
That's rad. Well, it sounds like everybody had a great time seeing Jaws 3D.
Yeah.
You know, my grandma, whom I knew quite well, but who never went to movies with me. Mm-hmm. One time we did have to go to a movie to kill some time. I think I've mentioned it before. And we saw Troll together with Sonny Bono. That's the one movie I saw with my grandmother. So weird.
Owen G writes, the one man against the world of monsters type of plot always reminded me of my French teacher making us read this insane play called Rhinoceros. The gist of it was that a disease turns everyone into rhinoceroses, except for one abusive alcoholic who is humanity's last hope against the rhino apocalypse. It's about fascism or communism or masculinity or something. Based on my experience with the French, the rhinos probably represented Americans.
Yeah, it's about something. I have seen it not that long ago, actually. Heather was in it, a production of it. It's a play by Eugene Ionesco, written in 1959.
Yeah,
very insane. Insane enough that your grandparents might take you to see it.
But it's also was made into a movie with Zero Marcel and Gene Wilder.
Rhinoceros was?
Yeah.
For real?
For real. You haven't seen it?
No.
It's great. Joshua Allen Doch, let me know if I pronounced that correctly, writes, I originally read this back in college, but now I better appreciate Matheson's mastery of such otherworldly horrors as suburban neighbors wanting you to come out and join them, having a falling out with your carpool partner, home ownership / maintenance, people not following pandemic protocol. When did you last check the oil in your car? To-do list anxiety, hating yourself for never quite finishing the daily task and thus never getting to your long-term tasks. Mm. Lastly, the stomach-dropping paranoia that is, did I remember to shut the garage door?
Oh, man.
Excited. I have that exact same thing. I go, oh, no, I didn't shut it, did I? He goes on to finish, excited to be reading along with the podcast this month.
I mean, I'm sure that when he read it in college, he was like, there's a lot of Christ imagery in here, starts typing his paper. But yeah, as a middle-aged person, this is a totally different story because all of those tiny things leaving the garage door open. Mm. That's the stuff that really sells that book. Paul Mayer writes, with the return of marches for Dracula's comes the return of references to Dracula's paprika chicken recipe, described as excellent by Jonathan Harker. Boy, that's a horse I've beaten to death and then some. Still entertaining to me. However, you've never actually included the recipe in the podcast after all these years. It is provided by Leslie Klinger in the Annotated Dracula, note 12 of chapter 1.
Oh, nice. I own that, but I haven't read that part of it yet, so I'll have to go check it out.
Well, yeah, he's been on the show, too. I never thought to ask him about the recipe, so probably I think that Bram Stoker sourced that from a book about the region, and it's included in our comment there if folks want to check it out.
And that gets us to I Am Legend Part 2. Mucubus writes, man, I love this book. My biggest gripe with the Will Smith movie was that they changed him into a scientist with a huge lab instead of just some dude with a microscope trying to learn stuff that's way out of his scope. I don't think I could do what he does. Great coverage as always, guys.
Jake writes, I'd say that is what makes the short story more unsettling. The protagonist is just an ordinary guy. No special talents or insider knowledge to the end of the world. Where in the movies, it's big budget, starring Will Smith or Chuck Heston, big actor, survives the end of the world. The star power just kind of squanders the thematic tension. Yeah, that's true. And it is the issue with movie stars, is that they're larger than life. It's always nice when you see a movie and you don't know who the actors are and you can just absorb the story and believe that that's the character.
Yeah.
Author Meow writes, no, Chris, it's all librarians. Beautiful freaks, the lot of us. And Dennis Bashaw says, I am a librarian. I can confirm. Freaks!
Told you, dude.
I believe it.
Librarians, they like to get crazy. Professor Koshka writes, you mentioned the Pandemic board game. In early March 2020, before everything shut down, my friends and I got together and played Pandemic. We thought it would be a fun way to blow off the stress of what we were hearing on the news. By the end of the evening, after the game, I don't remember if we won or lost, we were all a lot more somber. Turns out making light of a major international tragedy wasn't quite the stress relief we'd hoped it would be. I haven't played it since then, and I think it'll be a while before I do.
I haven't played it since this thing went down, but I did pack it. I think the reason it came up is because it was sitting in my office. Do I get rid of this or do I keep it? And I kept it because it's such a good game.
It's a good game.
Designed so well. Pre-pandemic, I had a lot of fun playing it, and I'm sure it'll be fun again. I mean, how many games are World War II based?
Exactly.
Dennis Bashaw writes, again, I just finished reading this book, loved it. Listening to you guys talk about how Neville and Cortman were carpoolers together gives another aspect to Cortman spending all night yelling for Neville to come out beyond wanting his blood. Did he have to spend every day yelling for Neville to come out during the pre-pandemic times? That's a good mention because nothing makes you crazier than having to wait on somebody who should have known, should have been ready. Uh-huh. Was Cortman a smart vampire or just trapped in doing the same thing nightly that he once did daily?
I like that. Lord Rancid writes, don't think anyone's mentioned the low, low budget 2007 movie adaptation, I Am Omega, starring the almost martial artist legend Mark Dacascos. I remember him from Brotherhood of the Wolf and the Crow television series.
Oh, right. It's that guy.
Lord Rancid goes on to say, liberties were taken, weren't they always? Though not in such leg-sweeping, high-kicking, chain-swinging ways. But some of it is remarkably faithful to the book. Go watch it now for free on YouTube.
How about that? I didn't know we didn't mention that, and I didn't know anything about it.
After I read the comment, I went and looked at the trailer for it on YouTube, and it is low. It is a low-budget movie.
Is there some good vampire kung fu in it?
I didn't see any. But the vampires were pretty gross looking, and it was shot on video. You know, it's like obviously video. It was shot before. We've got that quality video now where it looks like film.
Right, right. This was just shot on Hi-8 or something. In captivity, right? There was an anthology book written in tribute to Matheson titled He is Legend. Mm-hmm. There are lots of entertaining spins on Matheson's work in there, including a collaboration between Stephen King and his son, Joe Hill. But there is also a prequel to I Am Legend in it. I Am Legend, 2, T-O-O. And to my memory, it actually is about this neighborhood coworker guy. I don't have the copy anymore, but I thought it was worth sharing now that Matheson is on the table. Well, that's interesting. Maybe we could find out more about Ben Cortman, and did he have to wait while Neville was doing his hair? That gets us into I Am Legend 3. Daniel Onions writes, now, Chris, don't blame St. Louis. I said I ate too much garlic there, and you said, well, that's St. Louis.
All right, yeah.
Garlic consumption in Lebanon can get pretty extreme. The usual trap for the unwary is creme tomb, often just tomb. Garlic. You know, that is actually what I ate.
Oh, there you go.
Which has the appearance of a very pale, open textured mayo, but which is in fact an emulsion of neutral oil, raw garlic, and water.
Wow.
It is essentially an exceptionally strong aioli designed to fill a similar role to English mustard or wasabi by providing a palate shocking contrast to rich foods, which is all fine until someone dips their chips in it expecting mayonnaise.
Yeah.
That's what happened to me. It's a little like one time somebody gave me pancakes with a big scoop of ice cream on it. So I thought, oh, that looks great, and took a big spoonful of that ice cream. It was butter. I ate a big mouthful of cold butter.
William Tank writes, I read this book on my lunch break at my college summer job, Tour Guide on World War II Duck. Wow, that's interesting.
Ducks were those tanks that could go in the water, I think.
Oh, yeah.
They're like amphibious tanks, yeah.
In Wisconsin Dells, there were duck rides that you can go on.
Oh, really?
You didn't take a duck ride in the Wisconsin Dells.
I might have. We went there in 81 and 84, and yeah. So that was a long time ago, but I'm an hour or so away from it now, so.
There you go.
You bet I'll be up there in Tommy Bartlett's World of the Future. As I recall, it was outdated in 84.
It was. William goes on to say, I will always remember turning the page and seeing the dog died, and it made for the longest afternoon of work.
Ugh.
Hard to be happy and upbeat with that on your mind. Thanks so much for the show.
Jeez, man. Can you imagine having to deal with guests and stuff when you're thinking about that dead dog?
Aww.
Amanda Larson writes, it's been so long since I've seen any large piece of media actually kill the dog in a non-dog-oriented movie. I feel like... It's just a great sentence. I feel like there was a running taboo against it for a while, just via word of mouth. People saying they won't watch something if the dog dies. And I remember being shocked when the dog died in the movie.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe they actually killed it instead of having it come back as the stroke of luck when the hero has his back against the wall. Wasn't it in Independence Day? Doesn't a dog jump in front of an explosion?
Yeah.
Maybe I was too young when the movie came out, but it really shattered my trust in the world of movies. Hey, I get it, because for us... You know, there were those Benji movies in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if it was the first one or For the Love of Benji, but he had like a girlfriend dog and one of the bad guys kicked that dog.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it messed me up, man. I didn't need to see that. Also shattered my trust in the world of movies. I Am Legend 4, Cole Karen writes. Chad, how often do you think about ripping off a person's jaw and stabbing them with it?
Mm.
I understand your point, but I don't relate to the example at all. I do wish more mind reading and fiction addressed intrusive thoughts. Sometimes telepathy is written in ways that make the characters being read seem paper thin. When your telepath can look directly into the brains of their supporting cast members, you need to work much harder to portray those people as more than set dressing.
Yeah,
I mean, with the jaw stabbing thing, I think I was trying to come up with something absurd to make the point, but that nobody would actually probably be thinking.
Sure.
So that I didn't have to be wrong about it.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Because I don't know what women want. Those broads are a mystery to me, you know?
Wait, did Mel Gibson jump on our podcast?
Yeah, he did.
Jason Thompson writes, this is one of those examples where the originator of the genre, basically the whole modern zombie genre, critiques itself. While most of the imitators that came after just stuck with the first three quarters of the book, the Last Man on Earth Adventures survivalist part. It's fun to shoot zombies and barricade your house. It's less fun to find out that you became so numbed by violence you were killing people who could have been cured the whole time. Actually, I'm not sure if the book says that they could have been cured, but at least you find out that your macho loner violence was ultimately a dead end. Whoops.
Oh, man. JP Briskonomicon writes, my wife and I stopped by our neighborhood used bookstore today, and it just happened to have a copy of the I Am Legend graphic novel.
There you go.
Mentioned last episode. Coincidence? Or proof that the world does, in fact, revolve around Chris Lackey?
What? Well, I wouldn't take that away from it.
I don't know. That's pretty solid proof. I had a friend who is not a fan of genre anything. Just sort of is like, why do people like that? It's not real. You know, one of those odd perspectives, odd to me, on fiction. You know, some people just don't enjoy it. But couldn't understand why Walking Dead was such a successful show. And I just thought, if you'd grown up in my neighborhood, this wouldn't be... I mean, all the boys were thinking about Cold War stuff when I was a kid.
Sure.
Where do I keep my guns and who, you know, what am I going to take over? And I just think that there's this survivalist, you know, we're all thinking about that sort of stuff, sure, at a level all the time. And so any apocalyptic situation in piece of fiction is very attractive because you like to think, who am I in this group?
Yeah, that's right.
Who would I be? I would be the bard that turns into a zombie 5 minutes in. The group would get together and they'd say, what are your skills? Oh, I'm an electrician. I can fix cars. And I'd say, well, you know, I could write a vampire song in a pinch. Well, let's hang out. We might need that. And then they'd go, no, we don't need that. You go outside and get the, you know, go get some resources for us. And then they'd lock all the doors.
I mean, it would be me too. What am I going to do? Oh, I've read lots of role-playing games.
Well, that's diversion. You know, they might need you because you can get everybody involved in recreation and all those staying up in the attic 30 days a night situations, whereas they just have to listen to me doing my vampire song. They'd be done with that. I don't, you know, I only have one right now.
Wow. Okay. You're really not selling yourself here.
I kind of want to be a zombie. Okay. I when I watch those things, I'm just lazy, I think, at heart. I go, I just give up. I mean, the zombies and the vampires, they have clear goals. You know, they know what they're going to do that day. That sounds good to me.
Makes sense. Lewis Davies writes, I've been listening to the BBC radio series Nuremberg, and the pills that Neville takes at the end as the crowd waits outside really reminded me of the phenomenon of very high-ranking Nazis killing themselves with cyanide before they could face trial. Considering when the book was written and its interest in the Cold War apocalypse, there is something in thinking in vampire society as being one that views Neville like Hitler, but which is about to enter a whole new age of strife born out of its solutions to the problems it faced. The vampire apocalypse and Neville were there World War II, but life in their pill-dependent society ruled over by a razor pike-wielding military caste will be their Cold War.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some commonalities there for sure.
Yeah. Well, obviously he wrote, I mean, this is only 10 years after the war was over.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm sure it was fresh on his mind.
Well, I think about also World War II is decorated with, aside from Hitler, you've got Mussolini and a few other really powerful dictators who fell out pretty quickly within an amount of time. So who seemed to be in control and calling the shots and then are getting strung up and having their faces kicked off. And I think it just shows the mighty can fall pretty quickly. That's why I like the ending of this book, honestly, because, you can't stay in that role of power forever. Mm-hmm. Michael Paul Shalmo writes, when Neville's rape thoughts came up in your discussion, I automatically got a bit nervous because it's such a difficult topic. I don't want to defend or excuse those thoughts, but I do think they're worth discussing. So I appreciate that you two chose to address it. Thinking about it further, I wonder if Matheson presents those intrusive rape thoughts as another way to ask the reader to confront the fact that this character is a monster. It's clear throughout the book that he's a violent man. These thoughts are another example of his capacity for violence. To me, the author seems to be trying to put the reader into an emotional conflict by attempting to build sympathy for this monstrous character. In that way, it seems sort of similar to Lovecraft's sympathy for the devil idea that you discussed recently on the Werewolf of Ponkard shows.
Thomas Painter writes, wow, I disagree. It's been a long time since I read it, but I don't think Neville is a monster. Neville is a monster to the vampires. If wolves took over the world, they'd tell horror stories about shepherds. That doesn't mean shepherds were always monsters. It's a matter of perspective shift, not an unreliable narrator situation where our protagonist was really a terrible person all along. Neville fights to survive and save humanity and kills bloodthirsty savage creatures that prey on humanity. The shift is to suggest that the perspective of the vampires is equally valid on a cosmic scale as the perspective of humanity. But that is different from suggesting that Neville is a monster as measured by human morality. Good people can have straight thoughts about doing bad things. Anyway, I do agree that Chris and Chad handled it well. I think that's the valid point there, that Chris and Chad handled it well.
I agree with that.
That's the takeaway from that.
From that discussion, that's my major takeaway, yeah. I think you two both have points. I probably agree that Neville isn't supposed to be portrayed as monstrous, but those intrusive thoughts are meant to make him very... it's not a black or white thing. It's shades of gray. This is a person who's doing the best they can under these circumstances. Far more than those intrusive rape thoughts are thoughts of his daughter and his wife and the family that he's had to leave behind. I don't think that he's meant to be portrayed as a monster, but I think he's meant to be portrayed as somebody normal who can be seen through that lens, as Thomas says. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I mean, you want to have Reacher type characters that are super heroic, and to have characters who are wrestling with base urges like that I think is just a truer kind of character. Aaron Levine writes, that moment you mistake the aliens from War of the Worlds with the aliens from Signs. Shakes head in disappointment. Yeah, I sure did. Just flew out because I think I said, you know, what if they could be destroyed by water?
Oh, yeah.
And in War of the Worlds, it's the common cold, right?
Yeah,
isn't that what kills the aliens?
Yeah, I
meant, you know, just something simple. But boy, I'm not a big fan of that Signs. I'm a big fan of the filmmaking in Signs, but as
That was a movie that I went to and I was eating it up with a spoon. Mm. And then the last 10 minutes of it, it just pooped in my face. It was just...
Wait, in a bad way?
In a bad way, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because
it was, I was so riveted by the mystery of it, how these people out, rural people, seeing this world event happening and how they're not directly affected by it.
Yeah.
It was so cool and there was so much suspense. And then all the stupid stuff with hitting them with the baseball bat and the water was their weakness. And like all that stuff was just so lame. It was just like one lame thing after another to the point that it got super ridiculous. And was there a twist at the end of that too?
Yeah, there was. I mean,
I don't even remember it.
Yeah, there was. It just got convoluted because what is it about? The existence of God or the existence of aliens or what? You know, so it lost focus a little bit. I think it's a testament to M. Night Shyamalan's filmmaking ability that people get so angry at him because you wouldn't get that angry unless it was so good and then got screwed up a little bit.
Wadams writes, glad to hear What Women Want finally getting a mention on your podcast. Definitely an underappreciated gem of the weird fiction genre. Few works have given me the same sense of hopelessness and existential dread.
Dude, that's ready for a remake, I think. Keep Mel Gibson in it. Let's do it. I'll jump into that one.
Professor Murder writes, I've been following HP Podcraft for over a decade now, and I was very pleased to see you diving into I Am Legend, my favorite vampire tale of all time. I used it as part of my MA dissertation, Duality in Horror. Why do we create monsters? We want there to be something worse than ourselves. What is best about a great story is how returning to it with the benefit of a new perspective, like your episode, can reveal something new. As the inheritor vampires are killing their way through the feral vampires outside his house, Neville is taken aback by their efficiency and the visible pleasure they are taking in killing. But as you pointed out, it's very possible that they learned how to kill so effectively from Neville and his observations on how stakes worked.
Mm-hmm.
His actions have made the monsters more monstrous. I also appreciate how the horror of the story can be said to examine the fear of life becoming habitual. What exactly does Neville keep living for stubbornly? It's chilling that he can find some peace in death only when he accepts that, like a vampire, he has become immortal. A new superstition entering the unassailable fortress of forever.
I guess we didn't talk about that much. Do you think that becoming that legend for Neville makes it all worth it in a way? Not worth it, but that at least I did leave something behind. It may be that I'm a scary boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
But I will be remembered in some way because I Am Legend is a little bit of a life cycle coming into adulthood story. I mean, you can read it on that level because I think that in young adulthood, you know, you have such aspirational, idealistic things that you want to have happening. I'm going to take on the world and change it fundamentally the way that Neville says, I'm going to take on this entire big problem all by myself.
Yeah.
And then later, so many disappointments pile up that there becomes, you know, there's sort of an accommodation mode. You know what? Mm. All I really want is to have my coffee in the morning and that's good enough for me. You know, you get into the routine and find a more basic level of things to live for, which he goes through, you know, the sort of according with reality. So I wonder if in the end, you know, would you be happy if you were remembered as the boogeyman?
I don't think so. And I feel like that was maybe the ironic kind of takeaway when he said that at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that he was striving to save humanity and humanity just changed and he was actually the problem.
Yeah.
And that was him going, hey, look at that. I am a legend. I'm the legend that was killing everybody and that everybody's afraid of. And
yeah, it's sort of like when all the kooks in Los Angeles who moved out there to be film performers, I think David Cross did a bit about this, and then they never succeed and they just get crazier and crazier. But then eventually they become the local characters whenever anybody shoots, you know, a movie in L.A. So they wind up getting in there. It's just not as an actor, like the guy with the turban that plays guitar on Venice Beach, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
or Angeline Eldridge. Gollum writes, considering Chad's fixation on the lewd, gyrating vampire women throughout this story, I think if you guys decide to come back to Matheson for a future episode, you absolutely must read his short story, Dance of the Dead. Well, if it's about that, yes, I will read it. I'm not fixated on it. You just said it. Lewd, gyrating vampire women. Put that on a movie poster and you're done. You did the blockbuster.
Yep.
You don't even, doesn't even need to be a good movie. So it's not just me. Also, those are great characters.
Was the Ed Wood film based off that?
Yeah, Orgy of the Dead is that was the original title. So. If they'd gone with that, people would have eaten it up. I listened to the CD, just the audio version of Orgy of the Dead, so much.
It's so good.
And it's so great and so entertaining. It's all on YouTube. And I wanted to send a clip to that and pulled it up. And, you know, it's an exploitation movie. It's almost like I forgot. And so I'm like, when you actually see it, I'm just thinking about, these women are probably like, I'll take this job. It's better than waitressing, you know, whatever. Uh-huh. I'm going to make my $100 for the day. I have to dress up like a mummy and dance around with my breasts out. You know, it's just so non-sexual in a way.
Yeah.
And a little sad. I highly recommend listening to Orgy of the Dead. Yeah. It's got a good Jamie Mendoza Neva score that I think they probably took out of a studio library unauthorized because the music's good. Now let's quickly close out with the comments show, which is called Blame It on the Mummies. Monster Talk writes, I assume the Haunted Wig story is Patreon only, so to hear it, you'll have to pay. To pay?
Yes.
It's a great joke, although that was the free one. So
it was the free one. Forrest Rush writes, did I hear right that there's going to be an Ursula K. Le Guin month? Fantastic. You did hear correct. We haven't officially planned it or picked the stories yet. So if you've got some good short stories of hers that are in our wheelhouse, please suggest them to us. I've got a friend who's a big Ursula K. Le Guin fan, and she's going to recommend some of her stories as well. So let's see if they line up.
Awesome. Well, this place I'm staying in has a ton of books here, and right on top of the stack when I was going to bed the other night, hey, look, there's Ursula.
There you go.
It was right there. So it's kismet. We're going to do it.
Michelle Albert writes, so in the current run of the Moon Knight comic, it starts with a couple of vampires that have kidnapped and turned some people in a pyramid / MLM scheme. It's pretty funny / horrible / believable. Also relevant because, as we all know, Dracula owes Moon Knight money.
Is that true?
Oh, a lot of money. Yeah. No, actually, that is from the comic book. And I've been reading Moon Knight for the last few years. And it's gotten much better because he kind of started off as a Bruce Wayne type. You know, he had like the moon ship and moon gadgets and stuff. And he's a lot more like a cool supernatural dude. And there's a lot of surreal things that go on with him. And I think the new Moon Knight show is reflecting that as well. I know we're recording this earlier, but it's started already and I've been watching it. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I haven't caught it yet. I have been reading Moon Knight as well. The whole mental illness thing has been a really good shock to that character because when he first came out, I thought Marvel was going, we want Batman, but we don't want him to be able to hide in the shadows. Can we just put him in all white? Deja vu with the vampire, Shoggoth Lord writes, chiming in early in this episode to point out, in Blade Trinity, Dominic Purcell isn't just Dracula, he's Dagon. I have no idea why, but they actually had Ryan Reynolds get on screen and say, the blood-drinking, shape-shifting, decidedly not a fishman, was worshipped under the name Dagon in the ancient past.
Wow.
I didn't know that or remember it.
I did not know. I didn't remember
that
either.
They picked that up out of the Bible or something, though, probably.
Yeah, there is a Babylonian god called Dagon who's different than our Dagon. Robert Taylor writes, I've spent the whole episode waiting for Chad and Chris to talk about, spoilers, Midnight Mass. Great episode, so I'm vaguely disappointed.
Sorry, I haven't watched it yet.
I haven't seen it. Me neither. Sorry. Lewis Davies writes, I'd be really interested in you guys talking about the Vampire the Masquerade role-playing game in a bonus episode. I think that it's been so influential on modern vampire stories and the evolution of the game from lightning in a bottle, new form of role-playing game, to its obsession with millennial apocalypse to its newest form is all interesting stuff. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of that game. I've been playing it for a long time and it's super fascinating. I don't know if we could do a whole episode about it, but I could talk about it.
I feel like we probably, if you cut out our mentions of it over the last 13 years, there'd be an episode for it because it comes up a lot. Yeah.
Steve Dempsey writes, I don't remember you having done Colin Wilson's The Space Vampires, filmed as Life Force. It's a return to the mythos in some ways. Didn't realize that that was the book it was based on, or maybe I did know, but I've forgotten. I do love Life Force, though.
And I'm not very familiar with Life Force. That might be something we could cover on a bonus at some point. Mark Brett writes, Dracula's Daughter, the first Universal Dracula sequel, kind of does what you were talking about for your sequel, Chad. It's about a woman who's been turned into a vampire by Dracula who seeks a cure for her condition now that he's dead. Granted, the whole thing's really just a big metaphor for lesbianism, but it picks up literally seconds after the end of the first film with Dracula dead, and it has no interest whatsoever in bringing him back. That's true. I actually watched that one recently.
Yeah, you were talking about that before.
Van Helsing trying to explain what just happened, which is kind of kind of an amusing. I like that as a sequel when the characters are in trouble for the first movie.
Yeah.
You know, the Son of Kong has a similar setup, which I always found interesting. But I think, you know, when I was a kid, I watched Mark of the Vampire, which was the non-universal sequel to Dracula that's got Bella in it, because that was all I was interested in. Right. Given what I did, I can see why people are always putting Dracula in the movie. That's all we have for this comments show. As is evidenced by this year so far, we can talk about Dracula's forever, and we will once again. Thanks, patrons, for supporting us and listening in, and please keep commenting on these shows. It's always great to hear what you have to say, and you guys are pretty smart.
Thank you so much for backing us, because if you didn't, we would not still be doing the show.
It's true.
And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to The Comment Show.
It's a comment show in April about March, and we're done with it. That's all, folks.